Wake up, Coastal Carolina. Wake up. This is your CCTA Wake Up Call.
Produced by the Coastal Carolina Taxpayers Association, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to the preservation of the U.S. Constitution, free enterprise, and individual liberty.
Good morning, Coastal Carolina, and welcome to CCTA Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Rick Hopkins. Good to be with you this morning. Hey, I think we got a great show today. The topic is state sovereignty. This past Tuesday night was our regular monthly meeting open to the public, and we bring in guest speakers. Well, this month we brought in Diane Ruffino. Diane's from the Pitt County area. She's a constitutional attorney. She's a scientist. She's an author. She works with the 10th Amendment Center, and she's very knowledgeable on the subject of the Constitution, both state and federal, and on state sovereignty. So I asked her opinion on some of the federal overreach I'd seen. She called it tyranny rather than overreach, but Diane came and talked to us about that. Three examples I asked her to talk about were number one, the marriage amendment, where 61% of voters here in North Carolina voted for the amendment that declared that marriage was between one man and one woman. The second topic was on House Bill 2, which again, North Carolina passed a law and a federal judge overturned it. And the third one is probably most important. That was the voter ID law, which the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals has declared unconstitutional. And Diane is going to talk to us about those subjects. We're only going to listen to the part about the voter ID today. And then after that, she's going to tell us about her solution, which is the 10th Amendment or nullification. So without further delay, here's Diane Ruffino.
Let's look at the national trend of voter ID laws. Why an ID? Now look at this. After the 2012 election, only 31% of Americans have confidence in the voting process. So states began asking for an ID at the polls as early back as 1950 through 1980. So five states had voter ID laws. Not meaning that they had to have a photo ID. They asked for a photo ID, but they also accepted other forms of ID. More states began to ask voters to present some form of identification, and by 2000, 14 states had some laws in place. In the 2000s, voter ID as an issue began to take center stage. In 2005, the Commission on Federal Election Reform, aka the Carter-Baker Commission, made a bipartisan recommendation for voter identification at the polls. Now we're starting to talk about an ID. Soon thereafter, Georgia and Indiana enacted a new strict form of voter ID. Instead of requesting an ID, these states required an ID. If a voter did not have the required ID at the polling place, he or she voted on a provisional ballot. And that ballot was not to be counted unless the voter returned within the next few days to an elections office and showed the required ID. These went into effect in 2008 after Indiana's ID law, strict ID law, was upheld by the Supreme Court. Our voter ID law is the same, almost the same as Indiana voter ID law. We have the same elements. In 2011, 2012, and 2013, the pace of adoption accelerated for photo ID laws. States without ID requirements continued to adopt them, and states that had less restrictive requirements adopted stricter ones. Many of the stricter laws were challenged in court with mixed results. Our NC voter ID was passed in July 2013, and it was effective January 1st, 2014. It's HB 589, and it says, every qualified voter voting in person in accordance with this article shall present photo identification bearing any reasonable resemblance to that voter to a local election official at the voting place before voting. Now, there's a provision included for those who do not have a photo ID or claim they can't have access to the ability to get an ID. As Representative Sanderson was telling me earlier, the ID requirement for our voter law was really not even the most important provision. We had, at least the ones that challenged, eventually challenged. Okay, our voter ID law also made changes to voting dates, early voting, Sunday voting, and other provisions. On June 18th, 2015, changes to the law were hastily made in order to anticipate a legal challenge by the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, and that was in federal court in Winston-Salem. The legislature eased up on the ID requirement. Now, there's still an ID requirement in place, just eased up a little bit. Voters who lacked current photo identification will now be able to cast a ballot after providing their birth dates, the last four digits of their Social Security number, and an affidavit stating that there is a reasonable impediment to their ability to present a photo ID. On April 25th, the Federal District Court upheld the NC voter ID law, meaning they couldn't find any undue burden on voting generally presented by the provisions by the photo ID requirement. On July 29th, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit reversed it, holding that the law evidences intentional discrimination by our legislature and instructs that the provisions challenged be unenforced, be enjoined. It's insanity. The decision is not a good decision. All right, so let's look at the lawsuit. So it's a three-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit, and they struck down almost every challenge provision. I think they struck down every challenge provision of the voter ID law. As they wrote on the very first page of the decision, these provisions of the voter ID deliberately target African Americans with almost surgical precision. Okay, so you can see where the decision's going to go. Now, which provisions were struck down? The ID requirement, because it disproportionately targets African Americans. Elimination of the first week of early voting, because it disproportionately targets African Americans. Eliminates the one Sunday voting, the souls to the polls, because it disproportionately targets African Americans. Same day voting, because it disproportionately affects African Americans. Provisional voting, disproportionately affects African Americans. Provisional voting, out-of-precinct voting, disproportionately targets African Americans. Pre-registration or early registration disproportionately targets African Americans. All of these voting tools apparently make it easier for African Americans to vote, and therefore, because they have been limited over the previous law, they are intentionally discriminatory. I was blown away by this. The judges found that the Voter ID Act violates Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the 14th and 15th Amendments, and the 26th Amendments, which gave women the right to vote. Very disturbing decision, as my demeanor will show. They didn't seem to consider any of the legislature's legitimate reasons for the changes to the voter ID law. And here are some segments that I pulled out of the decision. This is just a show. Look at this. A leader of the party that newly dominated the legislature, in parentheses, the party that rarely enjoyed African-American support. Duh. I mean, what about the Civil War and the Reconstruction? I mean, they were all Republicans. All right. Announced an intention to an omnibus election law. Before enacting that law, the legislature requested data on the use by race of a number of voting practices. Upon receipt of that data, the General Assembly nefariously, enacted legislation that restricted voting and registration in five different ways, all of which disproportionately affect African Americans. Here, another one, the asserted justifications cannot and do not conceal the state's true motivation. In essence, the state took away minority voters' opportunity because they were about to exercise it. This bears the mark of intentional discrimination. Okay, now, I just want you to note that the restrictions in voting have no effect on the other minority group, Hispanics. Here's a couple of my thoughts reading this decision. Did the Fourth Circuit fail to properly consider other factors? They just seem to be concerned about race, 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 race. Okay? Did they consider existence of voter fraud in North Carolina at all? I asked Jay Delancey of the Voter Integrity Project, and he said he could not get his data in the trial court, in the federal court. They did not hear evidence, data of voter fraud. So that's one of the main reasons, right, for for the voter ID. Now, the legislature bent over backwards from what I remember, reading, and from what I heard from my legislators, is that the legislature bent over backwards not to do anything that could legitimately be called racial discrimination. They took their time, they made sure that the language and the provisions were just right, that they comported with the voter ID laws that have been upheld by other courts, and especially the Supreme Court. Again, they modeled it after the Indiana law. Now, I'm going to tell you about the Indiana law when I get to the bottom here. Do they consider the very real problem that voter fraud causes in the integrity of the voting process? Remember, 31% of Americans have no or have very little or have any confidence in the voting process. Do they consider the balancing of interests posed by the voter ID law? Voter integrity versus ease of voting. How easy must the state legislature make it for voters, especially when one group seems to need all the provisions and tools possible? What's their obligation?
Okay, we're going to pause right here to hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Diane Ruffino right after this break. Welcome back to CCTA Wake Up Call. We're going to pick back up with Diane Ruffino and talking about the federal tyranny overreach in overturning the North Carolina voter ID law. Diane?
Back in 2000 or whatever, there used to be one day set aside for voting. Election day. If you didn't make it on that day, everybody was disenfranchised. Now we have, what, almost a whole half a month? Isn't it up to each state to make such a weighted decision between fraud and ease of... Isn't that a traditional police power, traditional state function? Is there an entitlement to early voting? That's another question. Is there an entitlement to Sunday voting? Without some regulation, common sense ID requirements to prove that you who you are is who you say you are and where you live, it doesn't amount to fraud and abuse. I mean, if you allow the fraud and abuse, that actually undermines the system, which is the bright line constitutional rule, one person, one vote. If someone uses fraud and votes twice, my vote is canceled out. And here's another thing on that segment I pulled out, that it talked about the legislature intentionally trying to make it harder for African Americans to vote because all of a sudden they found out they have voter power and they were planning to use it. They used it in 2008 and 2014, which is the entire time of that they were talking about in this decision. They didn't get out in record numbers in 2008 because of all of a sudden we gave them Sunday voting and 3 weeks of voting. They got out because they had a chance finally to vote for an African American president. They'll vote when they want. If it matters to them, they'll get out and vote. It's not the opportunities we give them. It's that they need to be motivated. The Indiana decision, the Indiana voter ID law, basically the same law as us. It was challenged in the Supreme Court as being burdensome, requiring a photo ID. It was too burdensome. And a lot, you know, there were plaintiffs. One was an elderly lady who said she couldn't get a photo ID, and it was too hard for her to get it. So that law is decided or challenged on being burdensome. The court said, no, it's not burdensome. It's fair. In fact, that little old lady that they thought was the most credible, her son picked her up every day to take her to do errands. Every day he picked her up, he drove by the motor vehicle place. He could have stopped at any time to get a photo ID, which that law, just like ours, made that provision in the law. So the Supreme Court said, no, it's not a burden. Ours, the same provisions, photo ID, the difference is ours was challenged as being racist. So we have burdensome, racist. All of a sudden now you look at the law differently. It's the same law. It's not a burden to anybody, but it's racist. You have to ask yourself, why all of a sudden, if it's found to be unburdensome to everybody, why now is it all of a sudden too much of a burden for our African-American citizens? This, I think they're just making North Carolina an example. You know, they just want the opportunity to cheat. This is a critical election. Again, I have to emphasize what the federal courts rule and what the U.S. Supreme Court rules is not the law of the land. The law of the land is the Constitution. And guess what? The Constitution includes a 10th Amendment, which is just as vibrant and just as critical as any other provision in the Constitution. That reads, the power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people.
Okay, that was Diane Ruffino talking to us about the overturn of the North Carolina voter ID law by the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Diane is going to give us her solution to some of this tyranny right after we get back from hearing from our sponsors. Welcome back to CCTA Wake Up Call. You've been listening to Diane Ruffino talking about the federal overreach into North Carolina by overturning our voter ID law. Now, Diane has a solution, and she's going to explain to us what that is.
So what can we do, what can North Carolina do to fight federal tyranny?
Stop being
whipped. Okay. The first thing is stuff like this, is educating, is getting to know our documents. The Constitution, all right, it sets up the government, gives its powers, but really what it does is it protects us from federal tyranny. Okay, once the government steps beyond the powers expressly delegated to it, it's taking powers away from someplace else, right? And that's from us and from the states. So every usurpation, every overreach, it's taking powers away from someone that, or a party that it belongs to originally. So Roy Cooper, we don't like the guy. And it's not because he's of a certain party. It's just because he's not doing his job. He's not enforcing the laws of our state. North Carolina has to be willing to defend its laws, duly enacted by the legislature on behalf of its people, right? But the first step, if you want to be a sovereign, if you want to claim that the 10th Amendment protects your reserve powers, well then, stand up for your laws. Stand up for them. And this guy's just not doing it. So Governor McCrory, you know, we have Lieutenant Dan Forrest and our Republican legislators, they're doing that. They're courageously doing the right thing, and they're standing up for their laws that they pass. I mean, they're getting hammered in the media. They're getting hammered on liberal media, the news. They're getting hammered from governors and legislators from other states. But they're doing it. They're standing up. They're standing strong. They're going out on YouTube, going up on the news. And this guy is just a dud. He's got to go. Can he go? Yes, he can. It might be a little bit too late, but he can go. So there's a provision. We can impeach him. It's almost like the federal system. Article 4, Section 4 of the North Carolina Constitution specifies that the State House of Representatives has the power to impeach, and the Senate has the power to remove, just like the federal government. It might be too late. McCrory is taking control, and he's doing things that Roy Cooper should be doing. And then there's statute, section or provision 123. That's impeachment. Look at the reasons you can impeach. For willful neglect of duty. Could it be any clearer? Duh! In contract law, if someone breaches a contract, like this man has a contract because he's taken money, he's got a position, he's filled the position. So just like we know, you do the job, or in this case, don't do the job, and you get a paycheck. It's a contract. Now, if you default or you breach the contract and the aggrieved party now has to have that service done by someone else, guess what? The person that breached has to pay. So, I mean, if you want to go after this guy, I would love it. He's getting a salary. He's doing nothing. All right. Another thing we can do, state sovereignty bills. And in the North Carolina 10th Amendment Center, we push these. We push these quite heavily, and we have a couple model bills. This is not one of the model bills, but I have one that I kind of wrote for this particular occasion. The state sovereignty bills are really cool things. Such a bill would serve to reassert essential constitutional principles, reassert the 10th Amendment, reassert state sovereignty, and put the federal government, this is important, put the government on notice that it will not enforce federal policy or laws that exceed powers expressly granted to it under the U.S. Constitution. Okay. Such a bill evidences a position that the state takes the 10th Amendment very seriously and is paying particular attention so that the federal government doesn't usurp state powers. At least four states have passed them, including South Carolina. Wisconsin passed one It's a great one. It narrowly was defeated, but it went through the state house fine, and then I think it was blocked in the Senate. But it was a state sovereignty bill, reasserted the 10th Amendment, reasserted state sovereignty, and it listed five things. Put the government on notice. It says, government, you do any of these five things, including gun control regulation, we will consider that a fatal breach of the compact that brought us into the Union. In essence. Yes. So such a sovereignty bill might include this language. Okay. North Carolina views the American Union as being established by compact, by the ratification of the Constitution by the individual states by which they delegated certain definite powers to the general government. Now, some of these words I used are very important. That word compact is very important, and I'll explain why. Number two, the general government was created for special purposes only, to serve each state and not to do it harm. Three, while the states acceding, a very important word, acceding to the compact, acceding, delegated to said government certain definite powers, they reserved each state to itself the residuary mass of the sovereign right to their own self-government, as the 10th Amendment makes clear. Four, the government created by this compact was not made the exclusive or final judge of the extent of the powers delegated to itself. Five, whenever the general government assumes undelegated powers, its acts are unauthoritative, and North Carolina is not bound to enforce said acts. Seven. The states, including and especially North Carolina, were not united on the principle of unlimited submission to the federal government. Eight, North Carolina considers itself duty-bound to nullify unconstitutional federal laws and to interpose to prevent an enforcement for the benefit of its people who are entitled to the protection of the U.S. Constitution. This is probably one of the strongest tools that states have in their arsenal. Sadly, a lot of states don't use these because they've been corrupted by the government who tells them that it's illegitimate and unconstitutional. But if you don't think you can stop federal tyranny, think again. Use fresh eyes, and let's see what this remedy is all about. Nullification is a legal principle. It's a very basic legal principle.
Okay, well, that's about all the time we have for today. Again, we've been listening to Diane Ruffino, and Diane has a wonderful blog. If you're interested in finding out more about her and some of her solutions, the blog is called ForLoveOfGodAndCountry.com. That's ForLoveOfGodAndCountry.com. Again, that's Diane Ruffino, and she was our guest speaker this past Tuesday at our public meeting, which is held at the third Tuesday of every month, and it's open to the public, and you're invited to come and join us. Well, any other information you'd like to find out about Coastal Carolina Taxpayers Association and our efforts and what we do is located at cctaxpayers.com. Join us again every Friday here at 6:30 a.m. for CCTA Wake Up Call. Been my pleasure being with you today. Hope you enjoyed the program, and I look forward to being with you again next week.